طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. War with Iran. Not a day passes that we do not hear our media pundits speculate on this possible disaster. But they have good reason. President Trump is reneging on the Obama-signed nuclear treaty with Iran, so much for honoring our word on treaties, and the constant undercurrent is that we are doing this at the behest of Israel. We begin this morning with an analysis by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson that supports that argument, that Israel is driving the push to attack Iran, in a speech that was delivered in March of 2018 at a conference developed by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. We begin with his introduction to the conference.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is up next, and his bio is incredibly long, and he has a lot to talk about, so I'm going to shorten it. He is going to talk about, is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? And his last position in the government was as Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff from 2002 to 2005. And before serving at the State Department, Wilkerson served 31 years in the U.S. Army, and he retired from active service in 1997 as a colonel and has taught national security affairs in the honors program at George Washington University. And you're currently a distinguished visiting professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, and you're working on a book about the first George Bush administration. Welcome.
I have to identify myself with the remarks that were just made. Over some 400 students, graduate and undergraduate, and 12 years on two university campuses, and 6 years with about 1,000 students at two of the nation's most prestigious war colleges, we have determined, although it would be probably difficult to prove, and that's the reason we have covert operations, that Lyndon Johnson not only knew the gory details of the Israeli attack on USS Liberty in the Eastern Mediterranean, he also knew about what was just told you. That is to say, he knew the uranium was being diverted, he knew Israel was building a bomb, and he chose not to do anything about it. That's not my subject today, although I could talk on that sort of thing forever, as I'm sure. These days, I believe one gets the best insights into Israeli security policy, and perhaps even into Israeli policy writ large, which you've heard a lot about today, from the Russian emigre to Israel, a former foreign minister, and now its defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman. Whether it's his calling Arab members of the Knesset war criminals, or declaring the Jewish people should leave France, or claiming that the next military action against Hamas in Gaza will be the last, or contradicting his own military chief by denying there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, or stating categorically that the IDF will stop at nothing in order to win, reminding me a great deal of Dick Cheney, Lieberman is the living face of Bibi Netanyahu's Zionist policies. I sometimes think he would have rather remained in Russia so long as it was the Soviet Union and so long as he were in a significant position of power there. In addition to reminding me of Cheney, he is reminiscent of, and indeed might well be a latent version of, Joseph Stalin. As an aside, it is intriguing and I think well outside the usual conspiracy theory, to consider whether or not Lieberman has been intimated of our own President Trump might be an NKVD, GRU, KGB, FSB, you name it, plant. That is an agent of Vladimir Putin. He has more or less forged most of the 1 million Russian emigres since 1991 into a formidable political force, forming the political party that has more than once played kingmaker in the Israeli political scene. What a strategic coup for Vladimir, the master chess player in the world today, in my estimation, while everyone else plays a really lousy game of checkers. It would be quite a coup for him. Of far more concern at the moment and readily provable, unlike what I just said, Lieberman exemplifies where Israel is headed, toward a massive confrontation with the various powers arrayed against it, a confrontation that will suck America in and perhaps terminate the experiment that is Israel and do irreparable damage to the empire that America has become. Lieberman will speak in April in New York City at the annual conference of the Jerusalem Post. The title is, quote, "The New War with Iran," unquote. It is clear that he's in the forefront of promoting this war. And nowhere does my concern about such a war focus more acutely at the moment than in Syria. As President of France, Emmanuel Macron, described it recently, quote, "The current rhetoric of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel is pushing the region toward conflict with Iran," unquote. In that triad, no state is doing that more than Israel. Listen to Netanyahu in January at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem. Quote, "The greatest danger that we face of hatred for the Jewish people and the Jewish state comes from Iran. It comes from the Ayatollah regime that is fanning the flames of anti-Semitism," unquote. This anti-Semitism bit, of course, as we've heard it today, almost always a weapon of choice for Israeli politicians under stress, hurled in this case at the country whose Jewish population, by the way, the largest in the Middle East outside Turkey and Israel, lives in Iran in reasonable peace. And don't forget that these words are uttered by the man who is, as we've heard here today briefly, doing everything he can to expel dark-skinned African refugees, largely from Eritrea and the Sudan, from Israel, where most have come as legitimate refugees. President Trump's wall on the Mexican border is nothing compared to Bibi's actual policies. More recently, Bibi's performance at the Munich Security Conference bordered on the infantile, and yet effective when you think about the audience to whom he's speaking, as he held aloft an alleged piece on an alleged Iranian drone and asked Monsieur Zarif if he recognized it. Of course, Mr. Zarif later took his occasion at the microphone to characterize Netanyahu's performance as like that of a circus clown. Pretty good characterization, as a matter of fact. But I like the comment of Lebanon's defense minister even better. It went to the point. He said that he had an Israeli drone over his head virtually 24/7. That comment put the hypocrite that Netanyahu is in the right perspective. Of late, of course, Tel Aviv is increasingly using Iran's presence in Syria, its support for President Bashar al-Assad, and its alleged drive, and I love this one, my military comrades love it too, for a Shia corridor from Tehran to Aden as the hoary beast that must not be at any cost, including, of course, American treasure and lives, as his probable cause and existential prompt for action. That Israel has in support such disparate figures as Nikki Haley at the United Nations, Jim Mattis at the Pentagon, Rex Tillerson at State, as well as the usual suspects from outside the world of warmed-over neoconservatives, is indicative of such policy. But it's not just the usual suspects from the world of neocons, about whom I know quite a bit, having experienced them in 2001 and 2 and 3. Take, for example, my South Carolinian, fellow South Carolinian, Lindsey Graham, speaking 4 days ago after a breathless trip to Israel, a bipartisan trip, he called it. I don't know how anybody could use that term. And I caution don't laugh because Lindsey was serious, I think, but anything bipartisan with regard to Israel, call it unanimity. Call it absolute unanimity, anything but bipartisan. In fact, the proper words are probably overwhelming and an unprecedented unanimity. In fact, the only issue that does unify the United States Congress, other than mom and apple pie. But Graham had this to say, quote, "Anytime you leave a meeting where the request is ammunition, 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 that's probably not good." That's Lindsey. That's Lindsey. I know Lindsey well. "This was the most unnerving trip I've had in a while," he said breathlessly again. Graham went on to assert that, quote, when they tell you we won't help to deal with the blowback that might come from attacks on civilian targets where Hezbollah has integrated military capability, that was so striking. That was striking," end of quote. And then Senator Coons, who up until this time I've had some respect for, fairly sane and sober senator from Delaware, reported that, quote, "The tempo in terms of potential for conflict in Syria has gone up astronomically. The technologies Iran is projecting into Syria and southern Lebanon has gone up. Iran's willingness to be provocative, to push the edges of the envelope, to challenge Israel has gone up," end of quote. Coons reported this almost as breathlessly as Lindsey. "With the highest tech nation on earth in Syria, the United States of America, that is all Coons could derive from his visit. That the country that spends less than 1% of what the U.S. spends on its national security has introduced new technologies in Syria, technologies that threaten the country Israel, to whom the U.S. bounty is limitless? This is Joseph Goebbels' territory. Karl Rove is envious. The foundation for the defense of democracies as the heir to the Project for a New American Century, Bill Kristol's Iraq-bound think tank, leads that pack of wolves disguised as warmed-over neocons, lavishly funded by the likes of Paul Singer. It's even spawned the Institute for the Study of War, a fascinating Orwellian title if there ever was one. It should be the Institute for War. I've been asked, why is it that you ascribe to FDD and now the ISW such nefarious motives? I was asked this by the New York Times editorial staff when they published my op-ed on Iran a few days ago. My answer is simple, because that is precisely what FDD is attempting to do. Just as Douglas Feiss, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Office of Special Plans, did in 2002 and 2003 for Richard Bruce Cheney to lead us into war with Iraq. I've been there, done that. I don't need the tour. The salient question, though, why do you believe that America is headed for a struggle with Iran, needs an answer. Certainly, America's unquestioning support is required, as has been the case from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to the rapture-seeking Mike Pence and the tweeter and king Donald Trump. But it seems that recently, Lieberman and Netanyahu and their acolytes in this country, amongst which I put at the top Nikki Haley, have determined that it would be best if American troops also participated in the overthrow of the Tehran regime. From one point of view, I suppose this is understandable, the crassly opportunistic point of view, that is, that better to squander your own allies' blood and treasure than your own. But it's certainly not in the character that I'm used to with regard to the state of Israel, and certainly not with regard to the Israeli Defense Force. That force could handle anything Iran threw at it militarily is undeniable. Any military professional will tell you that. And that Israel's more than 200 nuclear warheads could decimate Iran is equally undeniable. So why this attempt to suck America into this conflict? I believe the answer is fairly clear once you push aside the cobwebs that surround it. The legitimacy of great power is what I call it, and that is precisely what Netanyahu and Lieberman desire. It's also what Riyadh desires, especially with the new boy king, Mohammed bin Salman. Now an erstwhile ally of Israel. In short, the IDF could defend Israel, but it could not attack Iran, not successfully anyway. And were it to do so, it would be damned internationally and thus isolated even more than it already is today, perhaps devastatingly so. But America, already damned by well more than half the world, polls show at least 4 billion people think we're the number one threat to their security in the world. Think about that for a minute. We've already done Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Afghanistan, we'd just be seen as continuing the trend. Besides, America has the military capacity, and here's the long pole in the tent, to project the power needed to unseat swiftly the regime in Tehran. Swiftly in terms of Saddam Hussein, for example, not swiftly in terms of taking care of 75 million people, each one of which in a very rugged and strategically deep terrain would want to kill every damned American in the country, along with probably half the rest of the Arabs in the area. So there's only one significant hang-up that I see with this strategy that Netanyahu and Lieberman are pushing. Embroiled in his own legal problems that just might send him to jail, as such problems would likely have sent Arik Sharon to jail had he not been in really bad shape at the end of his prime ministership, they're both headed for war. Of that, I'm convinced. They will use Iran's allegedly existential to Israel presence in Syria, which is becoming even more so from a military perspective every day. Hezbollah's accumulation of some 150,000 missiles, if we believe our intelligence agencies, the need to set Lebanon's economy back yet again, that's important. Look at what they're deliberating right now with regard to the new, very, very rich gas find in the eastern Mediterranean, with Israel claiming Section 9 and Lebanon claiming Section 9. Take that, Lebanon, we're going to bomb you, then you'll let us have it. And that will be their excuse. And we're looking at them taking on, and this is a point that all military people understand, a country that couldn't beat Iraq in 8 years of brutal, bloody war, an Iraq that we beat in 19 days. So this is the colossal threat that they're up against. And men such as H.R. McMaster are helping them. The much-heralded author of Dereliction of Duty, great title, and a man who knows about as much about Iran as I do about the 8th planet in the 95th solar system in the 50th galaxy past our own. And here's a hope I have. Let's hope that the chess master-in-chief, old Vladimir Putin, he that ruins elections from Paris to Peoria, is smart enough, once again, not to let this happen. I fear he'll not be, and we might have the stirrings of 1914, as utterly stupid as we now know those stirrings to have been. People to whom I mention such possibilities, people who are critically analytical and normally fairly sound in their thinking, respond that, well, don't you consider that sort of dreary prognosis a little bit overdrawn? My rejoinder is usually something a bit too clever, perhaps, but along these lines, don't you think a number of people said that in the summer of 1914? Ah, they respond, but have we not learned so much since then? I'll let you be the judge of that and inform you only that in my considered view, we have learned very little, and there are the ingredients right now with Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, losing dramatically in Yemen right now, and the United States and Russia at the peak of all of this to get engaged. A very distinct possibility. I looked at this from the perspective of the political parameters. What is it that we're confronting today in this country? And this took me down an entirely different path as I tried to figure out just how this team of McMaster, Tillerson, Kelly et al., and Trump at the top of it will face this sort of decision-making process. And the only place I could find that remotely resembled where we are today in our past was the period 1850 to 1860. And so about 6 months ago, I started reading as voraciously as I could on that period I'd done some reading, but I needed to really do a lot more. It is stunning, the similarities between that period and now, particularly in the political situation where one side of the country wouldn't talk to the other side of the country, and vice versa. And I was struck today by some of the comments that were made that resemble the comments that were made by my region, my state fired on Fort Sumter, after all, back in those days. And if that is the political situation in which this government will do its national security decision-making, then we are in deeper trouble than even the prospects of a region-wide and perhaps even bigger war in the Middle East. And the country that will have started it all, the relationship, unbalanced as it is, that will have made it possible, is Israel. And that's the danger we face.
You have been listening to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson speaking at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs conference held in Washington, D.C. Our Palestinian voice this morning is that of the activist law professor Nora Erekat, speaking at this very same conference on the topic of Israel's violations of international law. We begin with her introduction to the conference.
Our final speaker, Nora Erekat, is a noted legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She is an assistant professor at George Mason University, a co-founder and editor of Jadalia Ezin, and an editorial committee member of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Prior to joining the George Mason faculty, she served as legal counsel for a House subcommittee, legal advocate for the Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, and as the national grassroots organizer and legal advocate at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, now the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Most recently, she released a pedagogical project on the Gaza Strip and Palestine, the centerpiece of which is a short multimedia documentary titled Gaza in Context, which positions Israel's wars on Gaza within a settler colonial framework. She is also the producer of the short video Black Palestinian Solidarity and is currently working on a book project tentatively titled Justice for Some, Law as Politics in the Question of Palestine. It's a great pleasure to introduce Nora Erekat.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you to all of you. I think you are very brave to come to this session, which focuses on law, which in and of itself is meant to be obscurist in order to disempower people to take their lives into their own hands, and by its very definition is indeterminate. So what we believe the law to proclaim is going to be subject to our own mediation as well as judicial interpretation. So anything on its face that the law tells us can be subject to some sort of legal controversy depending on who the lawyer is representing. So I really appreciated Dr. Tilly's presentation, but if my client were Israel, I could use the very same legal framework to come to a very different conclusion, which is why our reliance on law has to come with a great deal of skepticism and with a strategic vision. With that in mind, I want to build on what was said earlier to discuss occupation law and the way that occupation law has not failed to stem the proliferation of settlements and settlers within the West Bank and in Gaza until 2005, but instead, without occupation law, Israel could not have and could not continue to expand and entrench its settler colonial presence within the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, and frankly, throughout Mandate Palestine. So quick note on framework. Dr. Tilly walked us through apartheid and said that this would recast how we envision this to now think of it as settler colonialism. I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, project that's distinct from colonization in that the settler who travels into the colony is traveling with their sovereignty with an intent to stay. That intent to stay in the colony and to assert their sovereignty also places an imperative to remove the native. And so that there are two processes at play. There is the removal of the native with the intent to replace them with the settler and to establish a continuous, uninterrupted, temporal, and spatial presence. And this is from Patrick Wolf's Logic of Elimination, so that the Nakba and the removal of the settler, of the Palestinians, isn't an event, but becomes an ongoing Nakba, as Palestinians have referred to it, but also fits in this theoretical framework. If then we begin with settler colonization as the framework, apartheid and occupation become two legal regulatory regimes that enable and fulfill those settler colonial ambitions of removal and replacement. So Dr. Tilley discussed one approach, I'll discuss occupation. I'm not sure how this works, but here's the map that you may be familiar with. Obviously, Israel never defined its borders. These are the 1949 armistice lines established in March that have never been declared in order to facilitate expansion. When Israel conquered the territories in 1967, 90% of Israelis polled wanted to maintain them, mostly for religious reasons, with having an affectionate relationship to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. But that religious relationship had no political legitimacy, and therefore Israel had no basis to remain and was compelled to actually withdraw. But Israel wanted the territories, wanted to get around the law, and again, as what was mentioned, how do you get through that elevator, wanted to get around the law. It couldn't annex the territories, even if it wanted to, because of the prohibition on annexation, which comes into disrepute in the late 18th century. Up until then, territorial conquest was forbidden. But it also, let's say that it didn't care about the laws we've seen in its annexation of Jerusalem and otherwise. It didn't want to annex the territory because it would have to absorb the Palestinian population, thereby disrupting a Jewish demographic majority that had been established in the aftermath of the Nakba and the removal of 800,000 Palestinian natives. So how then? And if it recognized the territory as occupied, it would have to revert the territory to its sovereign and maintain the territorial, demographic, and political status quo. So here's the problem. It wants the land, but it doesn't want the people on the land. If it annexes the land, it absorbs the population. If it doesn't annex the land and acknowledges occupation, it has to give the land back. So instead, Israel creates a new category in law known as, and declares that this occupation is sui generis, or distinct and unlike any other category, and argues that because Jordan's annexation of the West Bank in 1950 is not recognized by anyone besides Britain and Pakistan, and Egypt is only in authority of the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians don't exist as a people, that the territories belong to no sovereign. As such, occupation law, as enshrined by the Hague Regulations, the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as customary law, cannot be triggered. There is a sovereign void. This is not occupation by law, but shall be an occupation by fact. What does that allow Israel to do? It allows it the legal right to have presence in the territories without the legal obligation to maintain the status quo ante until the reversion of sovereignty. What does that allow for Israel? It allows it to incrementally take the land under two legal fictions, the legal fiction of military necessity and the legal fiction of temporality. As far as military necessity is concerned, the idea is that it is taking the land in order to create military encampments and that all of the civilian presence is temporary. Obviously, that's a contradiction on its face because you don't place civilians in a military encampment, otherwise you're using your own civilians as human shields, or it is in fact permanent. That is the first legal fiction. The second legal fiction of temporality is what Meir Shamgar, the military advocate general and then chief justice for the Israeli High Court for two decades, describes as temporality. It's a temporary presence of the civilians, but it is not, which is indefinite, which is the opposite of permanent. Meaning that it is not permanent, but we do not have to declare an end to it, and that is the opposite of permanency, and therefore can be temporary. That is a legal fiction. But these legal fictions survive. Because the law in and of itself, and especially international law, lacking a hierarchical adjudication system, lacking a reliable enforcement model, becomes subject to the political will of the international community, and therefore can vary by application, implementation, and interpretation as it does here. The United States is central to this interpretation. And it's central to this interpretation, despite the fact that it has its sub-administrations from the Johnson administration to the present, well, not this administration, have recognized that occupation law applies as a matter of law, not fact, and Israel is actually an occupying power, but has failed to implement its own interpretation of law for two reasons. One is, in the aftermath of the 1967 war, the Johnson administration determined the value of Israel as a Cold War asset in the Middle East as it vied with the Soviet Union to fill the power vacuum left by the European colonial powers. In that struggle to fill the power vacuum, what it decided and inaugurated after 1967 was a policy of ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge over any single one of its neighbors or collection of its neighbors so that it could prevail in a military confrontation should it arise. That's policy one. Before that, the United States had maintained a stalemate policy of equally arming Israel and its allied Arab monarchical regimes. So qualitative military edge. The second policy that it inaugurates, and this is another piece of this framework of why this sui generis occupation works, is that the Johnson administration also inaugurates and helps to orchestrate the Land for Peace framework, which is enshrined in UN Security Council Resolution 242. At the time that Israel occupies these territories, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the UN is in session and is in agreement that Israel is an occupying power and should withdraw. If, in fact, its attack on Egypt's Air Force, which had lain barren in the Sinai Peninsula and which was destroyed in 2 hours, if that initial attack was unprompted, then Israel has committed aggression, which is a use of force that is illegal, and therefore has the legal obligation to withdraw without preconditions. If instead that was a preemptive use of force or self-defense, then Israel has the right to remain as an occupying power, but under no circumstances to assert title or territorial conquest. Why does this matter? In the drafting of the Security Council resolution, Johnson personally himself wanted to ensure that Israel can maintain the territories as consideration for exchange in exchange with the Arab states for permanent peace as part of a contractual agreement. Johnson was senator during Eisenhower's administration when Eisenhower forced Israel, France, and the UK to withdraw from the Suez Canal. And so this, and Johnson thought at the time, Israel should have been allowed to maintain the Egyptian territory and hold on to it until Egypt agreed to normalize its relationship with it and to establish a permanent peace. Here in 1967, the opportunity arose again, and rather than apply international law and withdrawal as a legal obligation, instead it becomes reformulated as a political equation of a quid pro quo exchange of land when you give us peace. In the negotiations, there was disagreement Israel wanted to keep it. So there was disagreement about which territories were to be withdrawn from. And the debate then raged about the terms of withdrawal, of immediacy, what would come first, withdrawal or peace. There was one other piece of the debate, which was the armistice lines as being tenuous and not being the permanent lines. The Johnson administration, as well as the UK, urged that the definite article, the, be dropped from the resolution in order to permit negotiation on the permanent borders, but never, ever to actually change the territorial integrity. And so here is one. There were five draft resolutions at the time. This is the Latin American bloc resolution. You could see in every other draft resolution, besides the one that's ultimately presented by the United Kingdom that becomes the language of 242, the definite article, the, all the territories, is included. The U.S. votes for this, by the way. It doesn't pass because there's disagreement about the sequence of withdrawal or peace. This is the final resolution. This is actually 242. You'll see that the definite article is dropped. But in the preambular text, there's the prohibition on the acquisition of territory by war. In the actual clause itself, it's stipulated that it was occupied in recent conflict. We know that legal loopholes are coming. And state after state, including France, argue that this is to be understood as allowing for minor border modifications. But Abba Iban, who represents Israel to the UN during this time and is quite exceptional in his skills, explains very forthrightly, the resolution means what it says and does not mean what it does not say. Another legalese that becomes consequential to this present day, together with Israel's own logic of what it would need to establish permanent borders, this one articulated by Deputy Prime Minister Igal Alon, who argues that defensible borders would be tantamount to this. As you could see, all of the orange is what Israel defines as what its defensible borders would look like. And what would be necessary for security purposes, there is Jerusalem is part of that plan. There is continuity between the interior of Israel as well as its border with Jordan. It controls almost the entirety of the eastern border. This is what it wanted articulated in 1967. It is achieved far more than that. It is achieved far more than that into the present. So let me just also add here that this could not be possible to the present without Palestinian participation and acquiescence, as embodied and represented through the peace process that's inaugurated in 1993. The Oslo Accords themselves, Dr. Tilly referred that we should compare them to apartheid plans. I would urge you to compare them to the 1978 Middle East peace process framework established by Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that articulates a framework of autonomy without sovereignty. And it is verbatim. A replication of that document that never envisioned a state. A state was never part of the negotiations. And this outcome is not because the law didn't work. It's because the law has worked perfectly well and very effectively that we have this outcome. How does that work? So here are the three parts. Israel is claiming that it is a sui generis occupation, therefore it has no legal obligation to apply occupation law, including the prescription on civilian settlement and captured or encapsulated by Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, also tantamount to a war crime. And under their presence, they can both take the land under military necessity and remain there under the legal fiction of temporality. Then, why can they change the borders and not maintain the 1967 border? Because under Security Council 242, the resolution doesn't specify, it says withdrawal from territories, but doesn't specify from which territories. because of the lack of the definite preposition. And three, this would have totally failed as a legal argument because it does not withstand any judicial scrutiny and has been rejected by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court, by the UN Security Council, as we've seen most recently in UN Security Council 2334, as well as by multiple human rights organizations, but nevertheless remains valid as a legal argument because of the third prong, which is the U.S. provision of political immunity and support, despite its own policy imperatives, because it doesn't want to apply sanctions on Israel because that would diminish its qualitative military edge, and it doesn't want to apply international law as a matter of that would dictate the outcome because that would actually diminish Israel's negotiating hand in negotiations. And so those three parts together reinforcing create this outcome today, which has where Israel has taken the land but not taken the people and has enabled it to remove the Palestinians, to concentrate them and to dispossess them onto these plots of land. This scenario that we see in the West Bank very vividly also exists in the Gaza Strip, but even there, it's a very large concentration, and it too has been reduced in size the last time in 2014 by expanding the buffer zone by 40%. And if I had the map, which I do not, of Israel proper, we can see the concentration of Palestinians. Similarly, I think it was the first zone that Dr. Tilley pointed out to you, both in the Galilee region, which is the highest concentration of Palestinian citizens of Israel, or natives, essentially, as well as in the Negev. The concentration of Palestinians in the Negev is what is driving Israel today to remove those Palestinians forcefully, approximately 70,000 Palestinians, to place them into, concentrate them into urban townships, remove from their agricultural livelihoods, and to build a settlement, an Israeli settlement within Israel in their place in order to disrupt their ability to return or have a claim of that return, fully fitting within a settler colonial framework, which is what we are marching towards. And in fact, by defunding UNRWA, what we're doing is diminishing one. The idea is to make them indistinct from the rest of the Arab population so that they can be absorbed elsewhere in surrounding countries and therefore further diminish the demographic threat, so to speak, and further the idea of establishing Israel's Jewish settler sovereignty to be uncontested. That settler sovereignty to this day remains contested because of the demographic balance, and within Israel it remains an active frontier. There are other settler colonies in the world. Israel is not unique for this. The United States is a settler colony. What we see going on in the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually the removal of natives and taking away of their lands and obscuring the fact that they exist as a people and perpetuating a myth that the natives have disappeared in very similar ways that we perpetuate the myth of disappearance of Palestinians and their indistinct nationality with surrounding Arab countries. Thank you.
You have been listening to Professor of Law Nora Erekat speaking in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs annual conference held this past March. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.